This is The Think Tank with Dr. Mike O'Neill, talking about the major political, economic, and social issues of the week. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com. The Think Tank.
We have with us the negotiator. Marty Lotz is an expert in negotiation, and he's been on the show before. It's been over a year, I think. We'll go over some of the stuff before, but he's a product of the Harvard negotiation project. You want to tell us a little bit about that and kind of what some of the principles are that are part of the whole getting to yes and all that?
Sure. Well, that came out of the early 80s publication of Getting to Yes by my law school professor, Roger Fisher, and his colleague, Bill Urey. And it really jump-started the whole negotiation industry. And since then, there's been so much excellent research that really talks about that there's a right way to negotiate and a wrong way to negotiate. And what I teach and train people to do is to really help them analyze and evaluate and implement good proven research-based strategies and tactics. For instance, one of the fundamental components of getting to yes is to understand and to drill down into what your counterparts, not just what they want, but why they want it. We talk about it in the negotiation industry as the difference between an interest and a position. A position is what you want. It's relatively easy to find out what people want. It's oftentimes far more difficult to find out why they want it, their interest. What's the driver? What's the hidden agenda? What's really going on? Why are they sitting at the table in front of you?
And I read that book many years ago and found that was my impressive takeaway, is if you can get to what the true interests are, you can try to move rather than saying, well, you say you want X and I want not X. If I can figure out what your real motivation is, maybe we can work together in a way that we can both get what we really want.
That's right. And ultimately that led to, of course, the phrase that everyone's heard and uses these days, which is win-win. Mm-hmm. Right. Although we've also recognized since then that there are a lot of situations where win-win doesn't work. Our interests may not be aligned. There may not be mutual interests. We may still be able to get a deal done, but sometimes it's zero sum, where $1 more for you is necessarily $1 less for me. And then we've got to use a little bit more competitive strategy and tactic. And actually, when my book came out, Gain the Edge, in 2004, I really tried to make a distinction. There's a getting to yes interest-based world, but there's also a very competitive zero-sum world. And you need to know that there are circumstances in which you want to use the interest-based or problem-solving mm-hmm. approach, but there are circumstances where that's going to be counterproductive, and you really need to increase your leverage and focus on a little bit more competitive environment. And I think we're seeing that in a lot of negotiations these days.
Let's apply this to a couple of contemporary issues. In this state, educators and their allies are marching on the Capitol. They point out that they're 49th or 50th, or some of their opponents even say they're not 49, they're 42, I've heard somebody say, and that's good. But anyway, their position is that they're way underpaid and they want some adjustments made in that. They're facing a legislature and a governor that has been politically committed to no new taxes ever, ever, under any circumstances whatsoever. Most of them took pledges to that effect. I wonder if you could talk about this situation and apply whatever insights you have from a negotiation perspective. Let's take it from the standpoint of the teachers. What are appropriate strategies to go about how do those relate to the other interests that are potentially at the table?
Well, the teachers are really using this entire public effort to try to create leverage over the governor and the legislature in order to try to accomplish their goals and their needs and their interests, because working collaboratively in a problem-solving environment has not worked. They've tried that to the extent that they can, but as you point out, Mike, the legislature and the governor are saying no new taxes, no new money, and they've taken a very positional and aggressive stance, in fact, to such an extent that their political interests, reelection, would be at risk if they start to violate that those promises, or at least they perceive that to be the case. And so what the teachers are doing by really trying to raise the public profile of this and generate public support is to change the nature of the negotiation so that the governor and the legislature are going to say, you know what, we really do need to publicly fund teachers and education to a greater degree. Otherwise, our reelection interests, our public support, even our harder right-wing supporters are going to be upset because even they are interested in funding education and really educating our kids.
And I think my analysis of that situation is that the legislature and the governor tried to have it both ways. Basically, the recent proposal was passed, okay, there's a trust fund. There's basically a state piggy bank called the State Land Trust Bank. And what we're going to do, and this is already by law, constitutionally dedicated to education, we're just going to start to take money out of that faster. So we can get more money to provide some things for education, and we don't have to raise taxes.
Which would be the classic win-win, right? Yeah. Because it satisfies their interests in not having to raise taxes, not having to raise revenue. And yet it also satisfies the teachers and the education community's interests of increased funding. Of course, the big question as it related to that particular issue is nobody was really representing the future interests. Yep. Of education, which is what taking that money from the trust fund at least potentially damages.
Oh, sure. No question whatsoever. You take more money out of that piggy bank that feeds education. At some point down the road, there is less money in the piggy bank and somebody else is going to have to do something, either cut teacher pay, cut education, or somewhere along the line, raise taxes. But that's probably not a problem for anybody who is currently in office, because that's probably a 10-year down the road problem.
And that 10-year down the road problem person is not sitting at the negotiation table today.
Wow. So
so it's easy to take it from them, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So what do you do if you're the teacher? What's your next move if you're the teachers?
Well, I think you have to continue to generate this type of public support. You need to continue to be active, but they also need to get more politically active in terms of voting, in terms of changing the nature and keeping that issue visible, not only for the current representatives, but potentially also for any new representatives that they can elect and have that as a core fundamental issue that will continue to be front and center for the legislature and the governor. Change the politics of it, maybe change the politicians on it too.
And the resource that the teachers have is, I've seen the public opinion data on this, support for more money for education is at historically high levels because the cuts that have been imposed over the last 10 years have really come to strike home. At the same time, we have a lot of Republicans who do run the state. Democrats are marginally involved, except from time to time, who have taken tax pledges to never, ever, ever, ever raise taxes under any circumstances. And it looks like they've run out of gimmicks and ways to finesse this. You're either ultimately going to raise some tax somewhere, or you're not going to fund the schools beyond the level at which they're currently funded, which the public sees as unacceptable. But we'll leave that thought. But I want to tell you about what's going to come. We want to talk. The other big march that you've seen is the March for Our Lives. That was that they had a crowd of about 15,000 in Arizona, millions around the country, about 800,000 in Washington, D.C., but hundreds of cities actually around the world. We're going to also discuss that from the standpoint of negotiation when we return in the Think Tank in just a minute.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We are back with negotiation expert Marty Latz. We've been talking about negotiation as applied to the education issue in the state of Arizona, but there's been a second issue that has attracted huge crowds around the country and in this state, and that is the issue of gun control, gun safety, school safety. The March for Our Lives folks who were in here last week the student representatives of that in Arizona. We're going to they'd like to see more, basically more gun control. How would you assess what they're doing from a negotiation perspective, and they and their opponents, how would you strategize reach?
They're doing something very similar to what the teachers were doing, is trying to create leverage only at the federal level around this issue. As you've indicated, the public support for some of the measures that they are advocating for is pretty significant, but it hasn't translated into political support among the congressional representatives, although it did translate into some very interesting political support in the state of Florida, which passed some
They achieved some success.
They achieved some success among Republicans who had up until that point been adamantly opposed to any type of additional gun control measures. But if they can create the type of leverage that they hope to and translate it into political power in the fall elections, they've got a chance, I think, to do something significant. But if they can't sustain the energy, the activism, and they can't get people to the polls in the fall to actually vote on those issues, it's going to fall by the wayside. And that's what's happened with gun control measures after all of these tragedies in the past.
Yeah, historically, they've had very short life. I thought that the Connecticut shooting would be the one that would mobilize the public. I mean, the massacre of a bunch of kindergartners. I said, you can't get a more sympathetic group than that. If that doesn't motivate people, nothing will. I think I was wrong. I think I was wrong because these high school kids have been in position to articulate for themselves. They're an impressive lot. I mean, they have mastered social media, and they have gotten an incredible amount of exposure. And they are a sympathetic. I mean, these are genuine victims who can speak from personal. Now,
and let me just focus on that, Mike, because you make such an important point. The person articulating, or the individual, or the child articulating these, is really the frontline negotiator. And if you have the victims or the people who have been so powerfully emotionally impacted by these, who are able to articulate what they want, why they want it, and how they want to affect change, that messenger actually substantially increases the impact of the message. After the earlier massacre and tragedy, you didn't have those kinds of messengers. And so the messengers were the politicians who had always been talking about these issues, but they weren't nearly as evocative and powerful as these young kids coming out of the recent tragedy.
And one decision they made that I think was absolutely brilliant, when they had the march in Washington, not a single adult on the platform. Every single one of them was a teenager. I think the only some of the singers were, you know, they had a little bit of interspersed with entertainment, which these things always do. You know, they tended to be younger, but they were not speaking. Speaking roles were exclusively victims and students and siblings of victims. If you had any elected official up there, that person could have been attacked for their motives. I mean, there have been attempts to attack the motives of some of these kids, but what I've seen is boomerang. I mean, you're attacking a victim. You're attacking some. I mean, the comeback they have, I sat in a closet, you know, and I texted goodbye to my parents. And this is the person you're attacking the motives of? That doesn't work.
They're the person sitting at the negotiation table creating leverage, and the messenger makes a big difference.
Mm-hmm. Now, if I were to dissect this issue, if you were to go through a list of most of the objectives that they have, you know, no sales at gun shows, background checks, no automatic weapons, and all those kinds, every one of those is widely supported. The power of the gun lobby seems to me, their argument has been to not talk about any of those specifics, but just to say, oh, these people want to take our guns and repeal the Second Amendment. That's the level. When they say that, that gets some resonance and they win. But on all of the things that the kids are asking for, there is widespread public support, but there has been very little action on any of those.
And the reason there's been very little action on those is that the gun lobby and the NRA has a very active base and membership, and they get them to the polls and they vote. They vote in primaries. They vote in general elections. They are active and energized, and they make a difference in who to elect.
And I'd add, as a consequence of that, politicians in recent years have been afraid of them. I think what these kids have done is create the situation where there may be politicians who get afraid of them. You've seen them attack Marco Rubio in particular, but other politicians, you see the potential to say, you took NRA money, you know, give it back. Why'd you take NRA money? Is that more important to you than our lives? And that creates, what's the safe option for a politician without any particular principles who just wants to survive? It's less clear which of those two options is more efficacious for him.
They change leverage.
Yep. Okay. We will move on to some other issues. I want to talk some foreign policy issues, Korea, Iran, and the like, when we return with master negotiator Marty Latz in the Think Tank on KTR.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We are back with the negotiator, expert negotiator Marty Latz. We've been talking in the first couple of segments about some local issues, education and gun control as it relates to negotiation perspective. I want to turn our attention to the international sphere, in particular the issue of North Korea. I wonder if you could dissect that from a negotiation perspective, both sides.
Well, there's a couple of things going on in the North Korean negotiations. The first is to point out the real instinctive, intuitive nature of how President Trump negotiates. He's been relatively reactive. For a long time, of course, he was all fire and fury, tweeting about Kim Jong-un, calling him Rocket Man, names. And you had a lot of that going on. At the same time, what was happening? Kim Jong-un was developing nuclear weapons capability, increasing his ability and his leverage in these negotiations.
He's changing the facts on the ground.
And the West was trying to do the same by increasing sanctions. But in order for the West not just to increase the sanctions, but for them to have any impact and change its facts on the ground, it needed China. And for a little while, China and North Korea were on the outs. And China was enforcing those sanctions. Of course, we know what happened in the last couple of days. Kim Jong-un goes to Beijing. He has a meeting. He shakes hands with the leader of China.
More leverage for North Korea.
More leverage.
Even though we don't know exactly what they said, et cetera, there's some chumminess going there. I think the thing I'd point out about China, and most people miss this, they're in a very delicate situation. They are not crazy about this regime. They're not crazy about this regime having nuclear weapons, but they cannot completely put the screws to them because they are very much afraid of a collapse of North Korea and a intrusion on the Chinese border of a massive population that would make our southern border look like it was empty.
It's a buffer. It's a buffer for China. It's a physical buffer between the West and the mainland of China.
But I'm talking about the fear of mass. If the North Korean economy completely collapsed, they would face an onslaught of North Koreans going into China at levels that even China would have difficulty sustaining. So they don't want the country to collapse. They want to constrain the leadership. And as you point out, they're also a buffer. They like the idea that, I mean, they don't want, you know, U.S. influence to extend into North Korea, particularly militarily and whatever. But they're not crazy about the regime. So there's a lot of ambivalence in China.
Well, that's right. And it also gives North Korea leverage. in that context. And Kim Jong-un has been very smart about creating leverage in these negotiations. He implemented the charm offensive for the Olympic Games by sending his sister, by appearing reasonable, by sending a message to President Trump, oh, we're interested in discussing denuclearization. And
Trump says, I'll meet with you.
And Trump says, I meet with you without getting anything in return. Classic mistake.
And interestingly, one that Republicans, for the most part, were just completely aghast at Obama saying that he would meet with, he would meet with North Korea, and the basically Republican conservative establishment went ballistic, saying that that would be giving up a gem.
Well, but President Trump has such enormous levels of confidence and belief in his own negotiation skills and abilities, he thinks that he can get a deal done. Mm-hmm. He's the master deal maker, according to the art of the deal, of course. Mm-hmm. And the question is, I give him credit for being audacious, for taking advantage of a potential opportunity. My worrying concern is the level of detail and the level of homework and the level of preparation that really needs to occur before any potential summit with North Korea. And if that doesn't happen, I'm worried that President Trump will be so interested in getting a deal, a supposed win from his perspective.
Because that's part of his identity. He ran as, I'm the deal maker. I'm the guy who can make deals.
And I win deals. And they're win-lose deals.
So you're saying the two of them sit down together, that it's a situation where Trump may be more eager to make a deal than the North Koreans.
Well, and not only will he probably be more eager to make a deal, but the North Koreans, by virtue simply of sitting down in a bilateral environment, mano a mano with the United States president, they already have a win. So they don't have that same level of, I need a win to walk away from the table. And after all, they've got the nukes. They've got the delivery vehicles, and we don't have a good plan B to do anything about it, despite the appointment of John Bolton, who says that we've got a pretty viable military option to address that. We really, based on my understanding, we really don't have it, although we need to say we have it, because if we admit that we don't, it causes a perceived leverage problem.
It escapes me what that military option is, unless we're willing to allow the decimation of South Korea, which, if even in the remote possibility that we could take out every nuclear weapon that they had, and all is a tough number, right? With conventional artillery, they could destroy Seoul in 15 minutes.
And the leader of North Korea not only knows it, but he has communicated to the world a level of perceived irrationality and craziness that makes the world believe he would actually do it. And from a negotiation standpoint, that gives them leverage and power.
I don't think he does it first, because that would destroy the leverage is having the capacity and not using it. You know, I could destroy Seoul in 15. Now, of course, what would happen is we would destroy them, and that would be the end of their regime. So we can't do it. If we do it first, they destroy the South. So it's the old Cold War thing, mutually assured destruction. It's all on the Korean Peninsula, and therefore both sides can rattle their sabers. But neither side is in a good position. If you take a military action, something really bad happens.
Which is why we are trying to create the perception that we're willing to entertain and to engage militarily, even though most people believe we never would.
And ditto them.
And ditto them, but they have a far greater level of credibility in terms of our belief that they actually would do it. And that gives them leverage.
You know, I think Kim is cultivated this image of being a little bit crazy. I don't see anything crazy in his. I see him being very strategic.
I see him very strategic.
And by the way, let me qualify that by saying, I think the man is evil. This is not admiration. This is an analytical observation. This guy is behaving in a very rational, manner if his interest, in your terms, I think his interest is self-preservation, and he's acting very rational to preserve his regime.
And they've been doing it in North Korea. It's not only Kim Jong-un, it was his father, Kim Jong-il, and his grandfather. They've been doing it for 50-odd years, and we keep giving them what they want, and we keep not getting what we want. This is bipartisan. It's Democrats and Republicans who have messed this up over the years. I agree with you. Totally evil, but totally strategic. Who has been driving the agenda in this negotiation for the past 3 months? It is not the United States and the West. It is Kim Jong-un doing the testing, sending the charm offensive, going to China, inviting Trump to meet. Who is being reactive and instinctive and off the cuff? The United States. That's a problem.
What would you do now if you were put in charge of American foreign policy with respect to North Korea?
I think you've got a real problem on your hands because you have gone publicly out on a limb and agreed to meet. And now if you pull back, it creates additional credibility problems. I think I would get my team. And by the way, keep in mind, the North Korean expert at the State Department a couple weeks ago left. So our stable of experienced expert hands in this is relatively thin. But we've got to beef it up and we've got to try to do our homework to make this work. If there's any way to make that meeting not bilateral but multilateral, that would be a leverage enhancing
bring in multilateral
move.
Means probably China and South Korea as well?
Bring in China, bring in South Korea, possibly bring in Japan. You need to...
That'd be touchy.
It would be very touchy. It'd be very touchy. And, you know, keep in mind that all of these issues are also related to the Iran deal that is coming up for decertification in May. With the trade sanctions, we just imposed $60 billion of trade tariffs on Chinese goods. We need China. And if we decertify or if President Trump decertifies the Iran deal, why would North Korea ever do a deal with the United States if they see us doing a deal with Iran a couple years back and then reneging on the deal in the middle of the deal?
Well, you've teased perfectly the next segment where I wanted to move into Iran. There are certainly great parallels there in that in each case, it's a country that we don't trust that has either attempted to or actualized a nuclear capability that we don't want. Now, Korea's further along in that, but it's kind of the same thing. And we cut a certain deal with Iran. We're going to talk about that deal and how these two things may potentially relate to each other when we return for a final segment with Marty Latz here in the Think Tank on KTAR.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We're back with negotiating expert Marty Latz. We've been talking about, we moved into the foreign policy area. We talked about Korea. Now, just before the break, you pointed out that the Korea deal and the Iranian deal are related. Elaborate.
If you take a look at North Korea, and one of the crucial elements in any type of presidential negotiation, and I talk about this in my new book, The Reality of the Deal, an eye-opening look at how Trump really negotiates, there is a major difference between negotiating in business and negotiating at the presidential level. And in business, you need to and can be very, very competitive, but you don't really need to understand not only the other side's perspective to the greatest degree possible, but you also have your behind-the-scenes and behind-the-table negotiations with your own constituents. And you've seen that with President Trump and his base and playing to his base. In presidential negotiations, if you're North Korea, and I know it's a stretch for us to try to figure that we're over there in North Korea, and you're looking at the United States, you're looking at the Iran deal. You're looking at what the United States did with Muammar Gaddafi in Iraq.
And let's peel back and explain why that's the case.
I'm sorry, in Libya. So with the Iran deal, the United States did a deal. And we got a deal with all of our allies,
You stop developing nukes. We'll ease up on the sanctions. We'll return the money of yours that we froze in 1979. That was their money,
right.
By the way.
And by the way,
we kept it because we were in a nasty place.
Understandably, ticked off. And by the way, keep in mind that this deal was not just the U.S., but it was Russia, China, the EU. But if you're North Korea and you're looking at the fact that President Trump is looking to decertify and to back out of that deal, why would you ever do a deal with an entity, a country that does a deal and then reneges a few years later? Or you look at Muammar Gaddafi, Libya, you know, he gave up his nukes in a deal and we ended up taking him out anyways. Mm-hmm. So why would North Korea do an enforceable, verifiable deal that gets rid of their nukes with someone they can't trust in that context?
So you don't think they're getting the end result? I think the implication of that is the deal we may get, if we get a deal with North Korea, will not denuclearize them.
I think there's an extremely slim possibility that that would ever occur. And even if they agree to denuclearize, I don't see them doing it. Mm-hmm. And so then it comes back to the old phrase from, of course, Ronald Reagan, trust but verify. Mm-hmm. You know, they'll say they're going to do it. They'll say that we can come in and look, but they're going to have someone somewhere in some mountain, some underground facility, and they're going to keep their stuff, sort of like Syria did against Barack Obama with regard to chemical weapons.
Yeah. I bet they don't even agree to it. I bet they'll do some freeze, no more testing of either the nukes or the missiles.
I agree.
You know, and we're not going to do any more because they're giving up too much. And the other thing that it seems to me makes it very difficult for them is that we don't have a fig leaf really in the case of Iran, in that everything I've read is they are scrupulously adhering to that specific deal. Now, they're doing a lot of other stuff that we don't like.
It wasn't part of the deal. Now, you could argue, as I have argued, that President Obama should have gotten a better deal because we had stronger leverage and we didn't exercise it to the maximum degree. But the deal was done, and the deal is now still better than the alternative or our plan B. Because if President Trump decertifies the deal, and this was argued by, of course, former Secretary of State, now Rex Tillerson, and a number of the other foreign policy establishments, if we decertify the deal, what's going to happen? Iran is going to start to enrich uranium, and then we're going to be in another situation like we are now with North Korea, which is now they've got the nuclear capability, now they've got the weapons capability and the delivery vehicles, and then where are you? I mean, Trump is saying, I don't want them to have it in 10 years. If he decertifies the deal, they're going to get it a lot sooner than that.
And I think the thing to remember also about the Iranian deal, and probably any potential Korean deal, the reason the sanctions put the squeeze and they worked on Iran was that it was essentially the whole world, for all intents and purposes, the economically developed world, all participated in putting the squeeze on trade on Iran. If we unilaterally said we're not going to do any trade with you, the only person that we're spiting is ourselves, because they'll immediately trade with Europe and Russia and China and everybody else,
which is what they're doing now anyways.
Mm-hmm. So
you're right. And sanctions regimes are, as you point out, effective in creating leverage and causing pain.
If you get everybody in.
If you get everybody in on it. If you've got other countries like China that are going to say, you know, no, we're not going to let North Korea do this over our border. Mm-hmm. Or you've got other countries that are going to say, no, we're going to board that ship and we're not going to allow that ship to pretend to fly under another flag and violate the sanctions regime under the table.
Okay, we got a little more than a minute to go. What do you do yourself? Again, I'll ask you the same question about Iran that I did about North Korea. If you're in charge of our foreign policy from a negotiation perspective, what do?
You don't decertify the deal. You continue to try to negotiate a better deal and a different deal in addition to the deal that you have that impacts some of the other bad acts.
Basically, they're trying to expand their influence throughout the Middle East we handed them the biggest one. We handed them Iraq because Saddam Hussein was the biggest thwart to Iran there was.
And we've basically handed them Syria as well.
And then the hard part is, what is Iran's motive for going along with what we would like in that area?
Well, the silver lining from the West perspective is Iran really anticipated and needed foreign investment and Western investment in Iran to jumpstart their economy and to get out from the mm-hmm. sanctions regime. They haven't been able to generate that, in part because mm-hmm. President Trump has been so vocal in his opposition to the deal. If we can do another deal and they actually anticipate they will get some of that economic relief and mm-hmm. economic mm-hmm. development, that can give us some leverage.
There's some leverage there.
There's some mm-hmm. leverage there. It's not great, but it's what we got.
Okay. That's Marty Lotz I missed my time. We got yet another minute. You know what?
Fantastic.
Let you do. Plug the book. Tell us what the next book is.
The next book mm-hmm. is based on President Trump's really fundamental core message during the campaign about his qualifications, which was, of course, I'm a fantastic negotiator. I wrote The Art of the Deal. I'm a multi-billionaire. I am going to use these same skills as president of the United States on behalf of the American people.
Contrast, if you would, negotiating as a public actor, as president, from being in a private business.
Very, very different. Multiple players, multiple issues, multiple interest-based dynamics that do not require sometimes zero-sum thinking. Major differences, and we've seen it result in major challenges for President Trump.
Okay. Promise, you get an invite. Tell us when the book comes out. We'll have you back, and we'll talk about that in greater detail. This has been Mike O'Neill here with Marty Lotz, negotiator. You can find all of our previous podcasts, including two shows with Marty Lotz, if you look at ktr.com, or probably the older ones are a little bit more accessible at my website, mikeoneill.org. Twitter handle is Michael J. O'Neill. See you next week in the Think Tank.